honored tonight to introduce Sally Rush Wagner to members and guests assembled here. We feel especially fortunate to have Dr. Wagner with us this evening here in the realm of Women Get the Vote, a historic work at the 19th Amendment, which is currently on view just outside the doors. There's perhaps no one, can you hear well enough? Good. There's perhaps no one on the national scene more knowledgeable about the history of the feminist movement than Dr. Wagner, director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation in Fayetteville, New York, which is named after one of the most radical and far-sighted of the early feminists. Dr. Wagner has been immersed in the field of women's studies for many years. She's one of the great feminist historians of our era. Really so happy. She's an expert on the most remarkable of the early women's rights activists, including Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucretia Mott. The Gage Foundation is an educational resource for discussion and dialogue about the human rights issues to which Matilda Jocelyn Gage dedicated her life. Dr. Wagner was awarded one of the first doctorates in this country for work in women's studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And she was the founder of the first college-level women's studies program in the United States at California State University, Sacramento, to offer students a minor in the discipline. This at a time when such a subject is hardly considered worthy of academic scrutiny. It brings to mind similar challenges faced by early suffragists. Currently, Dr. Wagner serves as an adjunct faculty member in the Rene Crown University Honors Program, Syracuse University, and the St. John Fisher Executive Leadership Program. Author of numerous women's history books and articles telling the untold stories, more about that later. Dr. Wagner's most recent publication is an intersectional anthology, The Women's Suffrage Movement, with a foreword by Gloria Steinem, just published by Penguin Classics, and is outside the door, waiting for you. Other books include Matilda Jocelyn Gage, She Who Holds the Sky, think of the image when you think of that title, and Sisters in Spirit. Sally, you're going to correct me, but I'm going to say it first. The Haudenosaunee, is that correct?
That was beautiful.
Okay. Influence on early American feminists. Dr. Wagner wrote the Faculty Guide for Not For Ourselves Alone, Ken Burns' documentary on Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and appeared in that film in numerous history films and radio programs. She was also selected as one of 21 leaders for the 21st century by Women's E-News in 2015, and currently serves on the New York Suffrage Centennial Commission. Dr. Wagner is the recipient of many other awards, too numerous to mention here. We owe Dr. Wagner a debt of gratitude for her brilliant research on the influence of the Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois, as we call them, outside that world, on early feminists, their influence on early feminists. It was a story buried in the shadows of early 19th century history. Dr. Wagner saw into the past where others could not see. And Dr. Wagner once wrote, "I've been haunted by a question to the past, a mystery of feminist history. How did the radical suffragists come to their vision? A vision, not of band-aid reform, but of a reconstituted world, completely transformed." That was Dr. Wagner's quote, and I end this by saying, they turned to the Indians, whose world became their lone star. We look forward to hearing Dr. Wagner explain how the Iroquois inspired the course of feminist history and so much more. Thank you, Dr. Wagner. Mm-hmm.
Well, I am really honored to be here today. The book dropped 6 days ago. Gloria and I launched it on Friday, and this is my very first talk about the book. So I hope that you'll be patient with me and know that this is really the beginning. I would very, very much welcome feedback from you afterwards as well, if I could. Ask that of you. And it just feels so delightful and honorable to be in this library with this wonderful exhibit outside. If you haven't seen it, I want you to be sure to take a look at it before you leave. There are documents there that in almost 50 years of research, I have never seen. So it's an extraordinary exhibit. And thank you all so much, Harriet and Sarah, for all your planning. And I really appreciate the generous way in which you invited me here. Okay, we're going to play Mythbusters. I want to give you an outline of the narrative of the women's suffrage movement that I learned in Aberdeen, South Dakota in the 1950s, which hasn't deviated at all from what my Syracuse University students are telling me they're learning today. Let's follow. When does it begin? 1848, Seneca Falls, right? That's the beginning of women's rights in the United States of America. It's an undeviating line until 1920, when women focused exclusively on the vote, and it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. I should reverse that. Susan B. Anthony is what everybody knows about, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton is her second fiddle. One other thing. It was white women that organized and led the movement and carried the movement forward. It was all white women. Every single piece of that story is wrong. That's my contention. And tonight I'm going to try to convince you of that. We'll see at the end whether I've been successful. Gloria Steinem says in her introduction to the book, if I may read it, sends us off with unique encouragement. But what she really says is, unlike almost every other historian, she doesn't treat this country as if it began with Columbus. Women had political voice on this land at least 1,000 years ago. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Iroquois, as typically the French called them, we continue to in the non-native world, they formed the Confederacy 1,000 years ago. Women may have had political voice before then, but for certain we know it was 1,000 years. This is in past tense. My friend Louise, who was with us on Friday, Louise Hearn, is the Bear Clan mother of the Mohawk Nation. Louise continues, as do all of the clan mother, to nominate the chief, to hold the chief in position, and to remove him if necessary. There are three rules. He cannot have committed a theft, he cannot have committed a murder, and he cannot have abused a woman. I want you to just pause for a minute and think, who would remain in the federal government? Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote, now did the suffragists have any knowledge of the Haudenosaunee or Native women? Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote, of the Senecas of North America, the Reverend Arthur Wright wrote in 1873, and it's a quote from Wright, as to their family system, when occupying the old log houses, it is probable that some one clan predominated, the women taking in husbands, however, from other clans. That's how the system worked. When a woman married, her husband came to live in the longhouse with her unmarried brothers, her sisters, and their children, the clan mother and her husband. So this is a situation in which if men misbehave, they're going to find their belongings outside the longhouse in a minute. Usually the females ruled the house. The stores were in common, but woe to the luckless husband or lover who is too shiftless to do his share of the providing, no matter how many children or whatever goods he may have in the house, he might at any time be ordered to pick up his blanket and budge. And after such an order, it would not be healthful for him to attempt to disobey. The house would be too hot for him, and unless saved by the intercession of some aunt or grandmother, he must retreat to his own clan or go and start a new matrimonial alliance in some other. The women were the great power among the clan, as everywhere else. They did not hesitate, when occasion required, to knock off the horns, as it was technically called, from the head of the chief and send him back to the ranks of the warriors. The original nomination of the chiefs also always rested with the women. In this article, in this talk that she gave in 1890, Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes extensively about the authority of Native women through time and across the world. I actually have a short chapbook of the entire piece and her other writing in the lobby. Alice Fletcher, in 1888, the International Council of Women gathered in Washington, D.C. This was the first time that women had gathered. Feminists had gathered from around the world in the United States to talk about their rights. Alice Fletcher, who was an early ethnographer and anthropologist, gave a talk about Native women, and she shared this story. When I was living with the Indians, my hostess, a fine-looking woman who wore numberless bracelets and rings under her ears and on her fingers and painted her face like a brilliant sunset, one day gave away a very fine horse. I was surprised, for I knew there had been no family talk on the subject, so I asked, "Will your husband like to have you give the horse away?" Her eyes danced, and breaking into a peal of laughter, she hastened to tell the story to the other women gathered in the tent, and I became the target of many merry eyes. I tried to explain how a white woman would act, but laughter and contempt met my explanation of the white man's hold upon his wife's property. White women in the United States, had no right to their own property. Once they married, everything you owned, brought into the marriage or earned, became the property of your husband, and he could dispose of it any way he wished. This was not isolated. Common law was based on canon law, based on the idea that women are to be under the authority of men because of the sin of Eve, and that being under the authority of men follows all the way through St. Paul, from the Old to the New Testament. That becomes the foundation for common law, and Blackstone codified common law in Britain right before the American Revolution. And what he defined as the role legally of married women was to be legally dead in the law. That once you marry, you know, the church said the two shall become one and the one is the man, and following that through in common law, Blackstone says, you don't exist. The two shall become one and the one is the man. So it wasn't just that you couldn't vote, you had no right to your property, you had no right to your children. Husbands could will away an unborn child. You're pregnant, you're going to give birth, your husband grants a will before he dies. He dies, the will is read, give birth to the child, and the child is given to its rightful owner. And you have absolutely no legal recourse. So this is the position of white women. And these are these women who are looking at their nearby neighbors, the Haudenosaunee, and they're seeing these women who live in a world that they cannot even dream of. But once they see the vision, they know that it's possible. They're told it's religiously not possible. To go against this is to go against God's will, God's divine plan. They're told it's biologically impossible because you are the clinging vine to the mighty oak. They see women who have their authority, and they know that it's possible. And that, I think, may have triggered the women's rights movement. Now, how did Native women deal with this cultural conflict? Alice Fletcher says, as I have tried to explain our statutes to Indian women, I have met with but one response. They have said, as an Indian woman, I was free. I owned my home, my person, the work of my own hands, and my children could never forget me, children in the female line. I was better as an Indian woman than under your white law. Men have said, your laws show how little your men care for their women. The wife is nothing of herself. She is worth little but to help a man to have 160 acres. These are Omaha women, and they're seeing homesteaders getting 160 acres. One day, sitting in the tent of an old chief, famous in war, I later identified him as Sitting Bull. He said, to me, my young men are to lay aside their weapons. They are to take up the work of the women. They will plow the field and raise the crops for them. For them, I see a future for the men. The women were traditionally the agriculturalists, which gave them really, if we look at it in Western terms, control of the economy, because they were the ones who distributed food, they distributed clothing, the men lived in, with them in their longhouses. So you see the authority that these women had, and they also are in charge of choosing the government. He says, for the men, because they'll become the agriculturalists, I see a future, but my women, they to whom we owe everything, what is there for them to do? I see nothing. You are a woman. Have pity on my women when everything is taken from them. So at the same time that the suffragists are being inspired by Native women and the position that they hold in the culture, the civilized and Christianized, the Indians that became U.S. government policy is going into place. And the women, the Native women, are losing the rights they have at the same time that they're inspiring. It's this incredible cultural moment of pain, and I suppose on our part as non-natives, it's a time of humbly asking for the ability to be grateful to them and to also find ways that we may support their ongoing struggle for, as my Lakota friends say, sovereign women in sovereign nations to return to that position. And they're in the process of it. We can help if we want. The first real organizing is not in 1848. These women, most of them, are veterans of the female anti-slavery society. And I want to give you just a tiny glimpse, okay? The Third National Woman's Anti-Slavery Convention was held in 1839, again in Philadelphia. The year before, the convention was held in Philadelphia at a newly erected, wonderful building, Pennsylvania Hall, that was to hold all kinds of progressive activities. Well, the mob that grew outside ultimately became so fierce and frightening that the women were asked to leave. And when they were asked to leave, the women left, every white woman with an African-American woman, because of the fear that if the African-American women were in any way isolated, they could be really dealt with terribly. So they come back to Philadelphia, well, the mob, I should mention, burned down Pennsylvania Hall after that convention. The next year, these brave women return to Philadelphia for their next annual convention. and Black women were once again in attendance and leadership. Sarah Douglas continued as treasurer, and Grace Douglas, her mother, was a vice president. The convention incited such a threat of racial violence again that the mayor of the city asked the women to hold their meetings in the daytime and avoid being seen with blacks on the street, the white women. The women refused and responded with a resolution they passed unanimously, stating that, quote, the moral and intellectual character of persons and not the color of their skin would be the determining factor in whom the women would appear with in public. I want to also give you a sense of the issues that they dealt with. Not only were they working against enslavement in organizations, both locally and nationally, that were integrated. These were African American and white women working together. Actually, the first female anti-slavery society was started by women, African American women in Salem. Here's an example of the issues that they dealt with. Deeply has the conviction been rooted during the last 25 years. This is a writing from the time by a male who was an ally and a supporter of the female anti-slavery society. The condition of American colored women and the collateral topics included in the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, are the most important theme in the whole controversy upon slavery, because it combines the ecclesiastical questions with all the grand moral points. Now, I want you to read between the lines here. This is talking about, it's framing this in a religious framework. This is talking about the institutionalized rape of enslaved women. The date of this is 1837. This is a time when we think these women could never talk about anything about sex, huh? Or violence against women. They are calling out the institutionalized slavery or the institutionalized rape of enslaved women. Let me read just a little bit further and go behind the language to see what's being talked about here, okay? It's being framed in moralistic religious terms. The female slave upon whom her kidnapper has fixed his eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, is not only unable to deliver herself by flight, but she has no means of resistance. A white woman could assume the attitude of self-defense, and if she wounded, maimed, or even killed her brutal assailant, the law would exculpate her, and she would be honored for her resistance. But she who has a colored skin dares not to resist or attempt any opposition. And if through the impulse of desperation she should inflict a wound upon her ravisher in the very attempt, she would forfeit her mortal existence if the fact was presented to one of their criminal courts, and if that course was not adopted, her whole future life would be the subject of her despot's unceasing and malicious revenge. 1837. Have you learned anything new yet? I hope so. I want to do a part that has been dealt with extensively in history, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment struggle, because I want to give you a little different handle on it. I should go back to what's going on during the war, because the women who are raising all these issues in the 1850s, 1860, the war begins, and they say, we'll suspend our efforts for women's rights in order to support the war effort, but guess what? Lincoln at the time was saying the war was being fought to what? Preserve the Union, right? No talk about enslavement. The women gathered the largest number of signatures that had been gathered to that point in the United States, saying we will only support your war effort as long as it's being fought to end slavery. Mm-hmm. Did that have an impact? Who knows? Largest number of petitions, they couldn't vote, but they, many of them had husbands that they might have convinced. They also were very active during the war. You probably know this. They worked as soldiers, you know, they dressed as men and passed as men and were soldiers. Harriet Tubman led the first military expedition ever led by a woman on the United States soil. One of the things that the women's suffrage movement really talked about was the plan by Anna Ella Carroll for the Tennessee campaign. Now, this is controversial today. Some people say she really didn't plan it. But in the book, there is a whole piece written by Matilda Joslyn Gage that documents what, you know, the process with the names of the men who said that in fact she had. What Gage says is that Lincoln said during the war, we really can't let people know that this major war effort that really changed the course of the war for the North was planned by a civilian, and that civilian a woman. We need to wait until after the war to reveal this information. And then Lincoln died. Arlington was killed, and that was the end of that. But the end of the war meant that the 13th Amendment was required, you know, ending slavery and servitude of condition, except for prisoners, which, of course, continued the process of enslavement in the prison industrial complex today. So the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, and then once slavery was abolished, what are you going to do with the Constitution? William Lloyd Garrison had burned a copy of the Constitution at an anti-slavery convention on July 4th, 1854, calling it agreement with the devil, something of the devil and an agreement with hell, because the Constitution was a slave document. Two places it embedded slavery into the United States founding document. For the purposes of representation, enslaved people would be counted as 3/5 of a person. Now the effect of this, of course, was to create a slavocracy, a slaveocracy, as the abolitionists said, because what it meant was that the South had an abundance of representatives because all these enslaved people were counted as 3/5 of a person. But what are you going to do once you have no more enslaved people? You have to change the Constitution. So this gets changed once and becomes absolutely necessary too. Once the 15th Amendment is passed, which gives African American men the vote. Well, the fear was, we give them the vote, what's going to happen? You know, the South's going to stop them right away. So how are we going to protect them? We'll do an enabling portion to the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, which will say that the states cannot deprive anyone of their vote, citizens of their vote. But, oh no, we're going to only give men the vote. This was a critical moment. The female anti-slavery society had morphed into the women's rights movement, which had suspended during the Civil War, but then came back briefly. And they came back just for a year or two, and they said, you know what? We are going to incorporate ourselves into the anti-slavery society. And the anti-slavery society and the women's rights movement together said, you know what? This is the moment. We are going to fight for universal suffrage. I think it was Theodore Tilton, editor of the New York paper, who said, the door of freedom is swung open and it is time for the woman and the Negro to march through it arm in arm. Well, you know what happened. The African-American man went through and the door slammed shut for women. And the real kicker in this whole thing is the 14th Amendment, which defines citizens as male. It's the first time that the Constitution has had gender in it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it's thrown into question about women, whether women are even citizens. Was there racism during that time? You betcha there was. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, when they were given no money, as they should have been given, from the Anti-Slavery Society, that was once, the endowment said that once slavery is ended, the money should go to the other issues, including women's rights, but they wouldn't give the women the money. So they took money from a known racist, George Francis Train, and the paper, The Revolution, he funded it, and he had some editorial control over it. And you want to see racism in its virulent form? Yes, you will find it in The Revolution. This is not the policy of the universe, well, the American Equal Rights Association is what they called themselves when they came together. It wasn't policy. It was these individual women. What's interesting about it is that if we trace what happens afterwards, there was a split. And there were two women's movements, two women's organizations that formed. I'm going to just call them American National, American Women's Suffrage Association National, Women's Suffrage Association. American were the ones who said, this is the Negro's hour. We're going to just go with that. And we're okay with it. The National were the women who said, we got to have universal suffrage or nothing. And further, they said, some of them, Stanton and Anthony, who should get the vote first? Educated white women. And you begin to get that argument that we're going to see really in a terrible form later. So who should vote? Well, that becomes the real issue. How are we going to determine who is going to vote? The National says, we will fight for a federal amendment. And in fact, what happens during this time is that George Julian introduced an amendment in the House for universal suffrage. Kansas Senator Pomeroy, who had stumped the state for women's suffrage during the Kansas campaign, introduced a similar amendment in the Senate. So you have a women's suffrage amendment introduced into the House and the Senate in 1868. This constitutional amendment, had it been adopted in 1868, would have created full voting rights for all citizens, women and men, black and white. Congress, made up entirely of white males, ignored this historic opportunity, not even debating the proposed amendment. Congressmen had made up their minds to turn their back on women. They would open the door only a crack, wide enough to let through African American men, who were sure to vote Republican. And the Republicans were, of course, the party of Lincoln, the party that had been acknowledged with abolishing slavery. So I think if we look at this moment, I'd like to encourage us, instead of pointing fingers at this really difficult moment when there were African American men like Robert Purvis who said, I have a son and a daughter. I would rather that my son wait 50 years to get the vote than that my daughter wait one more minute, because as a Negro and a woman, she is doubly in need of the protection of the ballot. It was a very complicated, impossible moment. And I think who we should really point the finger of accountability at is Congress. Republicans controlled it. They could have made it happen in that moment. They had cold feet and they didn't. So that's a little different look at the that moment. So when these two organizations formed, the National is working for a federal amendment. The American, who had supported the Negro's Hour, is working for states' rights, is working for a state-by-state strategy. Now think about this for a minute. If they're asking the states to give them the vote as women, isn't the other side of that that they're saying, well, states then have the right to take the vote away? So interestingly, even though Stanton and Anthony are credited with terrible racism incorrectly during this whole fight, you know who most of the African Americans end up with? The National. They end up going with what ends up being the more progressive group. And the one that a federal amendment, you know, this is a moment when the U.S. is really trying to figure out who gets to determine who votes. Is it the states or is it the federal government? And you see what the effects of each of these groups are in that moment. The American is strengthening states' rights. The National is strengthening the federal government, protecting the right to the ballot. And if it's protecting the right of African American men to vote, it's also going to be protecting the right of women to vote, right? Once women get the vote. So eyes on federal amendment, eyes on states' rights. What are we going to do? Well, as activists, what would you do in this moment? You had this possibility of having the vote, and then all of a sudden it's gone. Well, Matilda Joslyn Gage, among others, and she really clearly articulated this. She said, wait a minute, let's look at the vote. Where does it come from? Is it a natural right or is it a given right? It's an inherent right. The right of self-government inheres in itself. So, the federal government has the responsibility to protect its citizens, right? Well, women are citizens. It has the responsibility to protect its women citizens. Is this a government based on the consent of the governed? Yes. Well, then, isn't it necessary for the federal government to protect the vote for women? And part of that means protecting women against the states that are denying them the right to vote. So what do you think? If you believe you have the right to vote, what are you going to do? You're going to vote. And it's illegal. And this is where we really see what a movement is. You know, this was not a lot of teacup ladies sitting around for 72 years saying, please give us the right to vote. That's the story I grew up with. No, these were kick-ass women who are saying, we have the right to vote and we're going to take it. Let me read you just a few of the women who did. This is just a tiny piece. Starting in 1868, hundreds, it may be thousands, of women across the country go to the polls, demand to be registered to vote. Some of them even actually voted, and some of them were denied. Well, more than 70 women in Washington, D.C., Sojourner Truth in Michigan, among the women in D.C. were Mary Ann Shad Perry, and I have to give you a shout out to her because I love this one. You know, you spend this much time with dead people, you come to dislike some severely, and you come to just absolutely fall in love. Well, I am totally smitten with Mary Ann Shad Perry. She was a member of the D.C. Universal Franchise Society and their spokesperson at the Colored National Labor Union Convention in 1869. Appointed chair of the Colored National Labor Union's Committee on Female Suffrage, she was joined by white suffragists Lockwood and Griffin, who were national, all of these were national members, you know, members of the National Women's Suffrage Association. Mary Ann Shad Perry was the first African-American woman to publish a weekly newspaper in North America. She went on to become an attorney and an active member of the NWSA-affiliated Universal Franchise Society. She was also a founder of the Colored Women's Progressive Franchise Association. Mary Ann Shedd Carey is standing in tonight for the hundreds of African-American women who were part of the suffrage movement. This was not a movement of white women only. We'll find out later it is. This is one of the problems when you live in the past, is that you don't have a time frame. So I'm going to cut out several things and just move forward. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories, if I could, rather than reading them. You can buy the book and read it. Okay. 1876, 2 years before this, a woman has gone before the Supreme Court. I'm lying. Women couldn't go before the Supreme Court. Her husband had to sue Reese Happersett for refusing to let his wife vote. So Frances Minor goes to the Supreme Court and says, this man violated the law. My wife registered to vote, attempted to, he wouldn't allow it. I want to sue him for $10,000. This was the test case of women voting. The Supreme Court, 9 white men said, if there is one case that can be said to be settled now and forever, it is this one. Women do not have the right to vote guaranteed in the United States of America. Sound like the ERA?
No.
But then it's resurrection time, right? So what happens? 2 years later, the government is celebrating 100 years, right? 100 years of a government based on the consent of the governed, and the women say, we have greater cause for discontent, rebellion, and revolution than did the men in 1776. They had local home rule. We are ruled by our husbands, our fathers, our husbands, and even our sons. So what did they do? They wrote a Declaration of Rights of Women. They asked for permission to present it. They were denied, and 5 officers of the National Woman Suffrage Association said whatever mandate to the contrary, they knew they would probably be arrested, and they said, we did this presentation not for the women of our time, but for the daughters of 1976, so they would know that their mothers of 1876 had impeached the government for its treatment of women. They wanted it to be placed on record so every woman in 1976 would know that this was the case. How many of you at the bicentennial in 1976 knew that your foremothers had impeached the government for its treatment of women? Michael Patrick Hearn. The historian that I've worked with for years and years and years, the biographer of Gage's son-in-law, L. Frank Baum, is the only person in the room. Thank you, Michael.
That was because of Gage.
Yes, and because of Gage, yeah. So this is part of a whole campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience. They vote, it's against the law. They refuse to pay their taxes. They begin a tax protest campaign on the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, saying, no taxation without
representation.
Makes logical sense, huh? Statue of Liberty goes up in New York Harbor in 86, and what do they say? This is the greatest hypocrisy of the 19th century. That liberty is represented as a woman in a country in which not a single woman has political liberty. They protest, banners flying at the anniversary. They also run a woman for president, 1884, Belva Lockwood. And let me just read you a tiny word from Belva Lockwood, if I might. The only way for women to get their rights is to take them. If necessary, let there be a domestic insurrection. let young women refuse to marry, and married women refuse to sew on buttons, cook, and rock the cradle until their liege lords acknowledge the rights they are entitled to. There are more ways than one to conquer a man, and women, like the strikers in the railroad riots, should carry their demands all along the line. She wasn't the first woman to run for president. She was the first woman to carry on a campaign. The first woman was Victoria Woodhull. You know about her? Yeah. Victoria Woodhull ends up spending election night in jail, arrested under the Comstock laws for exposing two instances of hashtag Me Too. One is the most famous minister in America, who is using his position as a clergyman to sexually violate. This is the language we can use now. 10 years ago it was seduce. Today we know that a man in that position, who uses that position to sexually pressure women, a clergyman, a teacher, you know, a psychologist, that's sexual violation. He was sexually violating his parishioners. You know what the second one was? A couple of Wall Street operatives who Victoria Woodhull and her daughter, or I mean her sister, Tennessee Claflin, watched at a big party in New York City get two 15 and 16-year-old girls drunk and sexually violate them. 1872. Hashtag Me Too, ain't you? So she spends the night in jail. We're gonna jump ahead, if we might. So they begin to have victories at the federal level, and they begin to have victories at the state level as well. But the American becomes more and more conservative, and the national remains and becomes, if you will, even more progressive. The national is the one who's doing all this nonviolent civil disobedience. The national is now with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage passing resolutions calling out Christianity and the church as the foundation of women's oppression. This is pretty controversial stuff. The American, on the other hand, has Henry Ward Beecher, the minister, the most famous minister in America, as their founding president. So you see there's real differences between these groups that emerge over this time. 1889, and this, you're going to have to read the book to get the full story of this, because it is very complicated. Susan B. Anthony has always seen the vote. That is, for her, the real issue. By the 1880s, the late 1880s, Stanton and Anthony, and the three of them are really the triumvirate of leadership of the women's movement. Gage gets written out, and you'll find out in a minute why. But Stanton and Gage are now saying the most important work of our life is to go after religious fundamentalism, because that is the biggest enemy of freedom. At the same time, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, this organized body of mother love for God, home, and country, is working not just to end the use of tobacco and alcohol in the country, but more importantly, to place God in the Constitution and Jesus Christ as the head of the government. In other words, to destroy the wall of separation between church and state. It would mean that anyone who did not give allegiance to a conservative Christian God would not be able to vote or hold public office. Gage says, this is the greatest danger of the hour. And Congress, the Senate, comes within one vote in, I think it's 1888, of putting God in the Constitution. So this is a really intense, difficult moment. Anthony says, wait a minute, maybe there's a problem with that, but they want to get women the vote. Frances Willard, who Gage calls the most dangerous woman in America, Anthony is courting her because the women's movement at its best was about 20,000 women. I sometimes get mixed up with all these names, bear with me. The Women's Christian Temperance Union has about 200,000 ultimately. So Anthony sees these women. Now maybe, yeah, okay, Frances Willard said she got a visitation from God that she should work for the vote so that to put him in the Constitution. Stanton sort of stands back and says, you know, strange that the Constitution doesn't recognize women who everybody has seen. God, who apparently Frances Willard may be the only one who's had a direct communication recently. But you see where Anthony's going with this. They've got the numbers. Bring them in. So she engineers a merger in 1889 between the conservative American and the progressive national that isn't even a merger. It becomes a states' rights organization. It becomes an authority, top-down organization. And I'm going to just really cut to the chase here. I'm going to read you one piece. Frederick Douglass's widow, this is his second wife, who was white, attended the National American Women's Suffrage Convention in 1900. This is after the merger, okay? 10 years after the merger, and Anthony is the president. And Helen Pitts Douglas writes to a friend after this convention, quote, "The colored people do not like Miss Anthony, and she has lost the chance of a lifetime, the chance to endear herself and her cause to thousands to whom suffrage is as important as it is to herself, the chance to put the association on record as standing squarely for humanity and loyalty, the chance to stay the advance of a spirit that is encroaching upon the safety of our republic and to lead and strengthen the moral purpose of the women of the land." Saturday evening, the delegate from Louisiana spoke, and three times the little thing declared for white supremacy, apparently to no one's discomfort, including Susan B. Anthony, who was in the chair. The National American Woman Suffrage Association chooses the route of expediency. That was the word that Susan B. Anthony used when she tried to explain to Ida B. Wells why it was necessary in order to win the South to practice racism. Wells, in one of the most brilliant analyses that I've read in her autobiography, starts this section, and it's in the book, with two instances of Anthony interrupting racism personally. No? One is Wells is staying with Anthony, and she has a lot of letters to write, and Anthony doesn't meet her secretary that day. So Anthony tells her secretary to help Wells with her letters. She comes back a little while later, and the secretary's leaving. She says, "Oh, are you done with all the letters?" The secretary says, "I will not work with a Negro." Anthony fires her on the spot. That is a case of interrupting racism personally. Anthony knew what she was doing, and then Wells says, when she tried to explain to me the expediency of, I think the instance was asking Frederick Douglass not to attend a conference when it was a convention when it was happening in the South. And Wells basically says, I was in 2 days. It's just a brilliant way of, you know, holding someone in respect for what they're doing and also calling to account for what they're not doing. It's for me one of the most powerful places in the book. So what happens? The National American, and I'm going to just give you the summary that I have here, okay? I don't expect any of you to believe this. If you don't want to buy the book, find it in your library. But this you need to read, because you shouldn't just take my word for it. But I'm going to give you the summary of what I came to. National American Woman Suffrage Association practices racism as policy. This isn't individual acts of racism. This is policy of the organization. They are making the argument, give women the right to vote, because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and women's suffrage is therefore a way to maintain white native-born supremacy. They allow the state organizations to segregate, which they do. They allow the state, any of the organizations, the auxiliaries, are independent. They can do whatever they want. They can work for Jim Crow laws. They can work for voter suppression, and they do. Jim Crow laws are strong today, and part of the reason we have never been able to get rid of them. Even, you know, African Americans, men and women, really didn't have the vote until the voting rights laws in 64 and 65. They are strong and were strong all that time, partly because the women suffragists worked for Jim Crow laws. They segregated their organizations. There's one account in the book where a woman whose skin color is lighter, an African-American woman, is allowed into the convention. A woman whose skin color is darker is not allowed into the convention. We have accountability as well as celebration that we need to do for 2020. If you'll allow me, I'd like you to read the end of the book, where I try to make sense of this and think it through. And it's the place where we all, I think, are called to think about this moment in history. If the call for equal pay for equal work, begun more than 150 years ago, had not been dropped, because the National American focuses entirely on the vote. They focus on state by state initially, and then when Alice Paul comes in with what becomes the Women's Party, they switch gears and finally, right at the end, support a federal amendment. Many women in states have had the right to vote by that time, and there's an incredibly effective and thorough list of it in the display outside, which I hope you'll take a look at. I realized, well, I don't have to go through that. You can just go outside and see a much better form of it that I could give you. So if the call for equal pay hadn't been dropped, they were raising it in 1850s. It was a little hat by 1850s. That phrase, equal pay for equal work. If it had not been dropped, might we have reached pay equity by now? Rather than the 80% of men's wages women earn on average? What if the National American had supported the Woman's Bible, which they denounced when Elizabeth Cady Stanton edited it, and she was their first president, and yet they turned on her and said, we have nothing to do with that. Never said a word about Frances Willard's writings, but they went after the Woman's Bible. What if they had continued to hold the conservative Christians accountable for using their religion to deny women our freedom? Would those religious forces be as strong today as they continue their fight against women's rights? how strong would a coalition of women, people of color, and immigrants' rights activists have been, combined with the growing free thought and reproductive rights movements. Women were raising issues of reproductive rights. In fact, there was a woman arrested under the Comstock lamps for distributing a birth control manual that she had written. Anthony Comstock, who was the press censor appointed by the United States government and determined what was obscene, determined that anything to do with reproduction was obscene. He threw the book at her. The judge said he was going to throw the book at her. And the woman was 50, Elmira Slinker. And she was in her 50s. She was going to go to prison. The next day she'd be sentenced for a long time. And Comstock had promised that he would rearrest her for her second book the minute she got out of prison. She killed herself the night before she was to be sent to prison, and her suicide note is in the book. She may be one of the first, if not the first, martyr to reproductive rights in our country. So how many, now this is one thing that really is important to me, how many black men's lives would have been saved if the National American had supported African Americans in calling for an end to lynching? What if the National American leadership had continued to fight the fourfold oppression of women by church, family, capitalism, and state that Gage and Stanton had identified in the history of women's suffrage? Where would we be today if the National American had kept the vote in perspective as simply a tool to gain our rights, not an end in itself, as the early cutting-edge issues? Everything from equal pay, reproductive rights, violence against women, you name it, they got left by the wayside, one after another. Our right to our bodies to be free of violence, to have full legal rights and employment, equity faded into the background. What if all those issues had continued on, rather than being dropped to focus just exclusively on the vote? As a result, when we got the vote, we forgot what to use it for. None of this is inevitable. History is shaped by those who swim with the tide as well as those who swim against it, stemming the tide of injustice. To choose not to act is the worst possible action. There are no innocent bystanders to history. Inaction ensures that injustice will continue in your name. The final words of the book are, "We the people determine history by our choices. One person's boldness can fire others. Two means someone has that person's back. A dozen can start a movement. 100 can swing an election. 1,000 can change the course of history. Individually, by our actions, or our lack of action, we are a part of determining the world our children's children will inhabit. Can we do better than our foremothers and forefathers? The opportunity to do so is the gift we are given and the responsibility." Thank you. Proof is in the pudding. If we look at women's voting patterns in the 2016 election, and we compare white women's voting and African-American women's voting, there's a part of me that thinks maybe the suffragists had an idea about voting suppression. One possibility would be that we take the vote away from white women and we double the vote for African-American women and women of color, and we see how fast this country turns around. I'm not suggesting that. It's just kind of a fun thing to think about. Yeah.
We're not feminists.
Question, comment?
Oh, yeah, yes. I'm so inspired. I just want to thank you for giving us back this history and these cautionary tales at a moment where we really need, especially the cautionary tales. And you know, you're talking about 2020. You know, I'm looking back at the Women's March and the fissures between anti-Semitism and racism and people focused on one issue rather than finding common ground. And I guess I just wanted to hear, you know, what you gleaned from this work that can speak to us at this moment.
The biggest thing that I learned is eschew, that word is fun, eschew expediency. Because if you are willing to settle for a piece of it, especially at somebody else's expense, you may win the battle, but you lose the war. And the suffragists won the battle and they lost the war, because 1920 was not an end point, it was a starting point. It meant that women of privilege could vote. And that meant, you know, Asian women didn't get the vote, African American women didn't get the vote. Native American women, it's a complicated question, because some Native American nations do vote. Others say it's a destruction of sovereignty. But they were forced to have the vote in 1924, whether they wanted it or not. They were not consulted. So it continues to be, you know, it's the vote is something we've got to constantly fight for. We're not a democracy, but it's a wonderful goal to keep in mind and work toward. And we will not be a democracy until we have a government based on the consent of the governed. And that is all the people, and corporations are not people. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just in terms of expediency, the House Hall gets the vote through in 1920, ratified.
Yes.
Immediately starts working on the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes.
How it includes all of these things. All of these things. And where are we today?
Thank you. 72 years, if we even start with 1848, 72 years to get the vote. 1924 it was introduced. Do the quick math. How many years have we been fighting for an equal rights amendment to the Constitution and we still don't have it? What's the math? 94? 22 more years than it took for women, from the time they first organized, as far as we know, to say, give us the vote. Now, if that doesn't make every single person in this room mad enough that you're going to go out and demand that the Equal Rights Amendment finally be ratified, because the three-state strategy is in play. Does anybody want to speak to the ERA and where we are right now? Or is that sufficient? Yes?
I want to ask a question with the book. Does it mention the women that went to jail?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's wonderful, I think there's the 1911 suffrage parade. There's a really good account of it out there. I had never seen that. It's actually in the book. The the, you know, women, they were imprisoned for wearing pants. They were arrested for voting. They were imprisoned for fighting for the right to control their own bodies and to share information about how to do that. And when the final stage of the vote, that is really a, you know, it's a, they're adopting the strategy of the national, and the women hold vigils around the White House. They call out the president when he's fighting for democracy in Europe and denying it to women at home. They burn his speeches. They burn him in effigy at one point. And the government arrests them, as it had the women, the suffragettes in England, who Alice Paul had learned from, and Harriet Stanton Blatch, Stanton's daughter. And so they adopt that strategy, and they're force-fed because they go on hunger strikes. And it's a very, very powerful, you know, they suffered greatly. And there are moments like that that really are, I think, worth celebrating. But at the same time, we have to take accountability and to try to heal, to work on things. We have an occasion right now with this anniversary to heal that rift that was created and continues on. There are some African American women who will not celebrate 2020, and they have real reason not to. And I think that if the book has any function that I hope it may serve, it is that I don't have an answer to what we need to do, but I know I suggested truth and reconciliation. I don't know what that would look like, but some way that we really take accountability. If we don't, you know, how do we hold accountable? I'm a recovering racist. I, you know, it's one day at a time. I'm filled with the poison of it, that it floats in the air. It's part of my heritage. It's part of my everyday life. I peel layers of it away constantly. But I hold myself accountable, not when I do something racist that's stupid and I didn't realize it. I loved Green Book. Mm-hmm. And then I read the reviews of it and think, one more layer peeled away. Yeah, that was a feel-good for white people redoing of Driving Miss Daisy. How did I miss that? You got a lot more work to do, Sally. You know, it's those moments of you know, when you're really actively trying to undo your own personal racism, every one of those is a gift because it allows you to shed one more thing. The place where I'm accountable is if I do that a second time, because then I knew better. Once you know, you can't unknow. And the place of knowing is the place of accountability. So for me as a recovering racist, it's that, what do I do to make sure that I become a person and never do that again? Because that's the place of accountability. And that's, I think, why I hold Susan B. Anthony especially culpable, because she so knew what she was doing. She had worked, she was an abolitionist, you know, a paid agent of the American Anti-Slavery Society. She knew what she was doing, and she chose. That, to me, is an act of self-conscious, deliberate racism.
Maybe one more question?
Oh, dear. There's three people. Can we do quick? I promise quick answers.
Whatever, you okay? You're in charge.
If we do three more? Okay, we'll do them quick.
Did Gage's critique of religious fundamentalism extend to racial intolerance and racial inequality?
Well, she ends up writing about the, I'll give you a couple of examples. She, in her Civil War speech, presentation flag, she said there will be no permanent peace in this country until there is absolute equality for every group, black and white, men and women, rich and poor, native born and immigrants. So her vision of freedom encompasses all. Maybe there's more to it. Woman, Church, and State is online and searchable. So, yeah. Jackie? This is a colleague, dear friend of mine.
Yeah, okay, it's all working quick. It's so exciting. I just want to make a comment about expediency, that listening to you with all the disturbing delight of hearing it at this current moment, listening to you just have to make so crystal clear the necessity for the 2020 elections to have a feminist framework for addressing the expedient single issue anti-abortion politics of a number of women in this country. Mm-hmm. It just crystallized that for me. Mm-hmm. And then my question is just to invite you to talk a little bit about what your image is for a decolonial feminism to bring us back to where we began retelling this intersectional history. What does that mean? We are on the land right now, of indigenous people. What is the multi-issue decolonial feminism that you practice that we need?
I'm gonna do one thing real quick. Let me just give you this. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage believed in the rights of the unborn. And you know what that means? They believed that every child had a right to be wanted and chosen. Now think about that for a minute. And I want you to work with that and think about it. The other thing is, I'm going to call out one tiny piece of it. What you're suggesting is like, that's the conversation we should all be having for the next year and then beyond. But I think that's a really absolutely primal question. But one of the things in terms of a deep, deep indigenous issue right now that affects all of us that I'd like you to, I'm just going to give you the, if you don't know what this is, Google it, okay? The doctrine of discovery. Look it up. That's the thing, one of the things that we should be fighting for right now. Michael?
didn't Anthony start off as a temperance candidate?
You know, for Stanton, it's really, really fast to disappear. And for Anthony, it really happens like for a brief period in the 1850s.
Yeah, but remember, she also mocked the 1848 convention.
Anthony?
Yes.
Oh, you're saying that's what she began.
Well, she
began as a
temperance person.
It's what?
She began as a temperance person.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise that she was dead going there.
Yeah, I think that was not the major thing that went on. Michael and I have these conversations back and forth. but I think that that it really was the numbers that attracted her. I'm not sure if she would have cared what, I think it didn't bother her. What Willard was going for in terms of that. Okay, well, thank you very much.